Supreme Court brief relating to a satirist. This is also a when these folks on the right talk about free speech, they really are talking about free speech of a certain type for certain people. They claim it's about all free speech, but it's really not. This is a really interesting case actually about free speech. All of those stories and more coming up today on the bonus show.
Thank your lucky stars. Every day you're not Dave Pakman.
Well, I have the pleasure of hosting the bonus show every single day. You can sign up at joinpakman.com, become a member, and we will see you on the bonus show in just a moment. Otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT. Word to your mother.
For those of you concerned. concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards. WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT in sound from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
As the Iranian government continues to severely repress street protests, Iran's feminist uprisings continue unabated, with women and girls now taking to daily acts of civil disobedience.
Women, life, freedom. That's the rallying cry in Iran and cities around the world in protest demanding justice for Mahsa Amini, the 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman who died after she was detained by Iran's so-called morality police for allegedly wearing her headscarf improperly. We'll get the latest on Iran and look at what cell phone video footage reveals about the protests. We'll also hear Angela Davis's message to the women of Iran. And then, as India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, offers to help efforts to end the war in Ukraine, we'll speak to the prominent Indian activist, Kavita Krishna.
The left and progressive people, we've stood unconditionally with the people of Vietnam, with the people of Iraq, with the people of Afghanistan, with the people of Palestine against American imperialism, American occupations, American invasions, and so on. And in the same way, we should stand unconditionally with the people of Ukraine.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden toured storm-ravaged parts of Florida Wednesday, pledging billions of dollars in federal aid for people impacted by Hurricane Ian, which made landfall last week as one of the most devastating storms ever to hit the United States. Biden viewed the storm's path of destruction by helicopter flying over Fort Myers Beach, which took a direct hit from Ian's Category 4 winds. He then met with Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, a potential rival in the 2024 presidential election. Biden said after their meeting the recovery effort could take years and blamed the climate crisis for adding to Ian's destructive power.
More fires have burned in the west and the southwest, burned everything right to the ground than the entire state of New Jersey, as much room as that takes up. And the reservoirs out west are down to almost zero. We're in a situation where the Colorado River looks more like a stream. There's a lot going on. And I think the one thing this has finally ended is a discussion about whether or not there's climate change and we should do something about it.
In Ethiopia, more than 50 people were killed, more than 70 injured in the northern Tigray region Tuesday after an airstrike ripped through a school housing people displaced by fighting between Ethiopia's military and separatist rebels. It's among the deadliest attacks carried out in Tigray since conflict erupted in November 2020, leaving thousands dead, millions displaced from their homes. On Wednesday, both Ethiopia's government and Tigray rebels said they'd accepted an African Union invitation to join peace talks in South Africa aimed at ending the conflict. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed papers formally declaring Russia's annexation of four regions of Ukraine. Putin's signatures came as Ukraine's military continued to claim battlefield victories against Russia, saying it retook more settlements in Luhansk and Kherson, two of the regions claimed by the Kremlin. Also Wednesday, Putin signed a decree declaring Russian control over the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest nuclear station, which has been occupied by Russia's military since March. In a video statement posted online, the head of Ukraine's nuclear power agency called on workers at Zaporizhia to resist Russia's bid to take over plant operations.
I am sure that your bravery will not yield to your wisdom, and you will not sign any deals with the occupier. You won't sign any statements and contracts. Don't do it under any circumstances. We will continue to work under Ukrainian law with the Ukrainian energy system. Don't doubt it.
Meanwhile, the New York Times reports U.S. intelligence agencies believe parts of the Ukrainian government authorized the car bomb attack near Moscow in August that killed Daria Dugina, the daughter of a prominent Russian nationalist. The Times reports American officials claim they were not aware of the operation ahead of time and would have opposed the assassination had they been consulted. In Russia, a former TV news producer whose on-air anti-war protest was seen around the world has escaped house arrest. Marina Avsyannikova made international headlines in March after she burst onto the set of a live news broadcast of Channel One, the Russian state media channel, appearing on screen for several seconds, shouting, "Stop the war! No to war," before the camera cut away. In August, Russian police raided her home, placed her on house arrest for allegedly spreading false information about the Russian armed forces. If convicted, she faces up to 15 years in prison. On Monday, she posted a video online from an unknown location declaring herself innocent, showing off an electronic tag around her ankle used by Russian authorities to track her location.
Esteemed colleagues of the Federal Penitentiary Service, put an electric tag like this on Putin. It is he, not I, who should be kept away from society and put on trial over the genocide of the people of Ukraine and the mass killing of Russian men.
OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, has agreed to cut crude oil output by 2 million barrels a day. On Wednesday, OPEC members, led by Saudi Arabia and joined by Russia, voted to keep global prices high by imposing their sharpest cuts to the world supply of oil since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Biden administration sharply criticized what it called a short-sighted decision to cut production while the global economy suffers negative impacts from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This comes amidst growing calls for the Biden administration to ban exports of U.S. gasoline, diesel, and other refined fuels. Food and Water Watch said in a statement, quote, "Political leaders here at home must understand the solution is not to increase drilling. Corporations are exporting record quantities of gasoline and making record-setting profits as a result. It's time to take real action to rein in this outrageous corporate profiteering," they said. A key member of the U.S. House Armed Services Committee has renewed his calls on President Biden to end arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the kingdom's efforts to raise oil prices. Congressmember Ro Khanna told The Washington Post Wednesday, quote, "President Biden should make it clear we will stop supplying the Saudis with weapons and air parts if they fleece the American people and strengthen Putin by making drastic production cuts," he said. Meanwhile, The Wall Street Journal reports the Biden administration is preparing to scale down sanctions on Venezuela to allow the Chevron Corporation to resume pumping oil there. In return for reopening U.S. and European markets to oil exports from Venezuela, the government of President Nicolas Maduro would agree to negotiate with U.S.-supported opposition groups over a new round of presidential elections in 2024. In the United Kingdom, newly minted Conservative Prime Minister Liz Truss faced protests Wednesday as she defended her proposals to cut taxes for the wealthy while expanding fossil fuel production. Truss was speaking at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham when a pair of Greenpeace campaigners stood up and unveiled a banner reading, "Who voted for this?" The pair had their signs snatched away and were escorted from the conference hall as Conservative Party members booed them. Greenpeace's Rebecca Newsom said after the protest, Truss should reverse a ban on fracking imposed by Conservatives in 2019.
Nobody voted for fracking. Nobody voted to cut benefits. Nobody voted to trash nature. Nobody voted to scrap workers' rights. There's a whole host of things that the Conservative government were elected to do in 2019 that they're simply not doing.
A new report warns one out of every eight species of bird on Earth is threatened with extinction. In its flagship State of the World's Birds report, the conservative group BirdLife International, the conservation group BirdLife International, finds half of all species are in decline, primarily due to habitat destruction and the increasing use of machinery and chemicals in agriculture. BirdLife CEO Patricia Zurita said, quote, "Birds tell us about the health of our natural environment. We ignore their messages at our peril," she said. A Michigan judge has thrown out felony criminal charges against former state officials accused of playing key roles in the Flint water crisis. The ruling ends a criminal probe of Eden Wells and Nick Lyon, two former leaders of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, who faced nine counts of involuntary manslaughter for failing to promptly report an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, which killed 12 people and sickened dozens. Also avoiding prosecution are former cabinet members of Republican ex-Governor Rick Snyder, who are accused of knowingly exposing Flint's residents to dangerous levels of lead in the water supply. Neera Sharif, a community organizer and director of Flint Rising, tweeted, "We have many people's lives that have been upended, including my own, and there are no consequences. Justice looks like someone going to jail, criminally accountable," she said. This follows a decision in June by Michigan Supreme Court to throw out charges against the former governor, Rick Snyder, and other former officials for their complicity in Flint's public health emergency. Flint Rising organizer Melissa Mays spoke to Democracy Now! After that ruling.
No one is being held accountable. No one is seeing justice. No one is seeing reparations in Flint. Our homes, our bodies, our lives are still damaged and destroyed. And the people responsible are getting away with it because, like Naira said, they have rich white folk and government heads have a whole different justice system than the rest of us.
In Thailand, at least 35 people were killed earlier today when a former police officer went on a murderous rampage in a nursery. Police say the 34-year-old suspect shot and stabbed children at a child care center in northeastern Thailand, killing 19 boys, 3 girls, and 2 adults. Thai authorities say the assailant then fled the scene, opening fire randomly from his car. He then returned home, killed his wife and child, and turned the gun on himself. It's Thailand's bloodiest mass shooting since 2020, when a soldier with an assault rifle killed 29 people and wounded nearly 60 others. In Greece, at least 15 migrants have died. Dozens more remain missing after a pair of boats capsized off the coast of Greece. In the first incident, a boat carrying about 40 asylum seekers sank off the eastern island of Lesbos. So far, 15 bodies have been recovered from the shipwreck, all of them women. Elsewhere, authorities are searching for survivors after a sailboat carrying about 100 migrants sank off an island in southern Greece late Wednesday. Japan's government has condemned another series of missile tests by North Korea. On Thursday, Japan's military said it detected 2 short-range ballistic missiles fired from North Korea into waters separating the two countries. This follows 4 other launches from North Korea in the past 2 weeks, including Tuesday's launch of an intermediate-range missile that flew over Japan. Japan's defense minister spoke earlier today.
These actions by North Korea are a threat to the peace and security of our country, region, and the international community. It's absolutely unacceptable.
Today, North Korea condemned the U.S. Navy after it redeployed a carrier battle group led by the USS Ronald Reagan to the Sea of Japan, saying U.S. actions were, quote, posing a serious threat to the stability of the situation on the Korean Peninsula, unquote. And the French writer Annie Ernaux has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. The Nobel Committee cited Annie Ernaux for the, quote, courage and clinical acuity with which she uncovers the roots, estrangements, and collective restraints of personal memory. Her books include Happening, about a young woman student who has an abortion. Last year, it was made into an award-winning film. On Friday, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize will be announced. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, as India's prime minister offers to help efforts to end the war in Ukraine, we'll speak to a prominent Indian activist, Kavita Krishnan. Stay with us. In These Times by Makaya McCraven. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Women, life, freedom. That's the rallying cry in Iran and cities around the world as protests continue demanding justice for Mahsa Amini, the 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman who died after she was detained by Iran's so-called morality police for allegedly wearing her headscarf improperly. Amini died on September 16th. Protests broke out the next day. The Norway-based group Iran Human Rights says at least 154 people have been killed since the protests began in Iran nearly 3 weeks ago. In a new report, Human Rights Watch has accused Iran's security forces of using shotguns, assault rifles, and handguns against peaceful protesters. The full extent of the protests or the security crackdown remains unknown, as the Iranian government has disrupted internet access in parts of Iran and blocked some messaging apps. But some video of the protests continue to get out. This video, obtained by Reuters, shows a group of female students heckling a member of an Iranian paramilitary force known as the Basiji. The female students are heard chanting, "Basiji, get lost." We begin today's show with two guests. Narges Bajoğlu is an anthropologist and professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Iran Reframed, Anxieties of Power in the Islamic Republic. Her latest piece for Vanity Fair is headlined Women, Life, Freedom, Iran's Protester Rebellion for Bodily Autonomy. Also with us is Nila Tabrizi. She is an Iranian-born video journalist who works at the New York Times. Her most recent piece is titled, What Video Footage Reveals About the Protests in Iran? Let's go to those pictures first. Nilo, if you could start off by talking about this project at the New York Times and what the video shows.
Thank you so much, Amy. So we examined videos that primarily were coming out in the first week, week and a half of the protests. That's when the internet connection was not as disrupted as what we're seeing right now. So we saw multiple things, and I can kind of boil it down into three main visual trends that we saw. We saw that protesters were targeting symbols of the state. So we saw protesters tearing down posters of Ayatollah Ali Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic. We saw protesters attacking police stations and government building complexes. And another main thing that we saw, which has been very much the topic of conversation about these protests, was really seeing women in the lead. So that's everything from the defining images of seeing women burning their hijabs in public to women cutting their hair as a form of protest. And as well, we heard a lot of women-centric slogans, like you just said, Zan Zendegi Azadi, that's very much been at the forefront of these protests. And as well, something that Dr. Bajokli has written about, we saw women really, what it seems like for the first time, putting their bodies in direct confrontation with the police. So they're, you know, actually going to physically fight them, going up to them, being very bold. This really stood out to us, and we saw that in multiple places across the country. And the last thing that we saw is just these protests have been so widespread. So we've seen solidarity among social class, different regions, different ethnic backgrounds. And something that really stood out to us for that is we saw protests in religious and traditionally conservative cities that are regime strongholds like Qom and Mashhad, where we can hear protesters saying death to the Islamic Republic. And as well, we saw, we could hear the chant, Zan Zendegi Azadi, which originates from Kurdish. We heard people chanting it in Kurdish in Tehran, so well outside of Kurdistan, which to us really showed, you know, this solidarity across the country.
And Nilo Tabrizi, if you could also talk about the state symbols that have been attacked during these protests and the significance of those state symbols. And in addition to this main chant, Zan Zendegi Azadi, Woman, Life, Freedom, there have also been others. What are the ones that have really caught on?
Sure, absolutely. So in terms of state symbols, we've seen, like I said, tearing down the poster of Khomeini. We've seen protesters tear down pictures of Ali Khamenei, the current supreme leader. We've seen them tear down posters of Soleimani. And seeing this is just very, you know, it's a very bold thing to see. There's so much repression in the state that seeing people tear down these symbols really gives us a visual understanding of what these protests are towards. It seems like they are very much calling for, you know, a complete restructure and a complete dissatisfaction with the current order. And as well, in terms of the other chants that have caught on, yeah, I mean, the main ones that we kept seeing are Zan Zendegi Azadi. We are seeing, you know, death to the Islamic Republic, death to Khomeini, really calling for a downfall of the system. Those are the main ones coming through. And this is something that, you know, perhaps Dr. Bajokli might have, you know, her thoughts on. But something that we saw was these chants are very much women-centered. So in 2009, for example, when Neda was killed in the Green Movement protests, she very much became a symbol of state repression. There were chants at that time that chanted her name. This time around, we're not necessarily hearing Mahsa Jina, her name so much. We're really hearing Zan Zendegi Azadi. And we're also hearing chants that particularly had male references translated into women-centric references. So the chant, for example, that we might have heard in previous protests is, I will defend, you know, I will seek revenge for my brother. We're hearing that I will seek revenge, or I will defend my sister. So really hearing that translated into a women-centric chant to reflect the movement.
Professor Nargis Bajorgli, your piece for Vanity Fair is headlined Woman, Life, Freedom. Iran's protests are a rebellion for bodily autonomy. In the piece, you make a very interesting point, which is that Mahsa Amini, a Kurdish girl around whom these protests began, around her death, that her real name, Gina, a Kurdish name, could not actually officially be registered under Iranian law. So could you explain why that is and the significance of these protests beginning around the death of this young Kurdish woman?
Kurds in Iran have been repressed both pre-revolution and post-revolution. A lot of the ethnic minorities in Iran, especially those who live in the border areas, have faced both severe repression as well as very few resources going to those areas of the country for development, for job opportunities, for all of those things. So, and many Kurds, as well as some other ethnic minorities in Iran, are not allowed to teach their languages in schools. And Gina's name could not be registered under Iranian law because under Iranian law, only certain Persian and Islamic names can be registered formally. And so they had to register her Persian name, Mahsa, instead of her Kurdish name, Gina. It's insignificant that this uprising has started over the death of a Kurdish girl who was visiting Tehran. She didn't live in Tehran. She lived in Saqqez, a town in Iranian Kurdistan. And, you know, these issues over identity and ethnicity have often been sort of fault lines that states have used in Iran to not allow solidarity to take place across the country. And what we see is that a nation rose up in defense of the death of a Kurdish girl. And the central slogan, as Nigel has been mentioning, of this entire uprising is a slogan that originates in Kurdish, comes from a militant feminist Kurdish background from Turkey, first of all, and then gets translated into the Kurdish women fighting in Syria and against ISIS in 2014 and 2015. And then it travels around and it comes to Iran. And the reason that it becomes a national cry is because during her funeral, you can hear mourners chanting that slogan. It gets captured on video, it circulates on social media, and then it spills out into Persian all across the country.
Professor, in your piece in Vanity Fair, you write, "It's only fitting it's Iran's feminist revolution and the country's young generations that are on the front lines of battles for bodily autonomy and sovereignty. For four decades, Iranian women and queers have borne the brunt of a political system predicated on their subjugation through daily policing and criminalization. They're now showing the world, despite the severe repression and potential death they face, how to fight back like feminists." Take it from there.
Yes, so this is really at its core a fight for women and queer folks to have choices over their bodies. So what's really important, as Nilu was providing the context, is that the Islamic Republic has implemented laws that that are severely restrictive for women since the very beginnings of the 1979 revolution and the start of the state. And what's significant here about what happened to Amini is that she was caught at the hands of the so-called morality police, which are a police force that are a daily occurrence all across Iran. All women have had some kind of interactions with the morality police, and families, including religious ones, have had some form of interaction with these police because their daughters may not be veiling as religiously as the mothers have. And so this is something that women are dealing with every day. When Amini was taken, first ended up in a coma and later died from the injuries that she sustained. What we are seeing is that the ways in which women in Iran have been resisting every single day against these restrictions over the past 40 years, we now see this as a rupture in collective action. So it's not surprising to me that sort of this generation's and in our global moment, our generation's first big feminist uprising that is militant in style is taking place in Iran on this level, because Iranian women have over four decades of experience of daily acts of resistance against patriarchal laws and against patriarchal norms. And so as conservative movements are rising across the world, as we see more and more laws that are coming down against women, and, you know, I think it's worth noting that conservative movements, when they rise, and religious movements, when they rise, first and foremost, they go after the rights of women. And so right now, I think even though traditional media has been very slow to cover this uprising, it's been internet users all over the world that have made hashtag Mahsa Amini trend. And that's the reason we're all having this conversation today. So it's striking a chord with people all over the world who are in one way or another experiencing either once again or a continuation of increased patriarchal control over women's bodies. And so the protests in Iran are capturing our attention because we're seeing in real life how women are putting their lives on the line and are refusing to comply any longer. You know, power and patriarchy requires that we comply. And so we're seeing now a young women and women across Iran who are just saying, I will no longer comply with this.
Professor Bajigli, I want to ask you about what you see as the potential outcome of these protests. I was listening to an interview on the BBC with a renowned Iranian graphic novelist, Marjan Satrapi, who said that irrespective of what happens, the Islamic Republic is now a corpse. But you write in your piece that, in your Vanity Fair piece, that the street rebellions may or may not succeed in toppling the regime or changing the laws, but that's almost beside the point. Can you explain what you mean by that and what the effects of these protests might be, even if the regime doesn't fall?
Right. So we don't, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't predict what's going to happen. But at the moment, what is very significant about these protests is that women are taking control back from the state. They are saying, we will not allow you to define how we come out onto the street. We will define this for ourselves. And so what is significant here is that, you know, when you rise up against powers and things that have been around for millennia, like patriarchy, which is, you know, unfortunately one of the universal values that we see around us. This is something that it takes we have to be able to envision that we can live in a society without that. And so what that requires is a representation of resisting that kind of power. And what we have now in Iran, for Iranians, which is extremely significant, is that we have on a daily basis now various forms of civil disobedience, which are about standing up against patriarchal power. And we're seeing more and more slogans also that say it might not be always the morality police, but the morality police could also be called your father. So it's going to the core of patriarchy in the state and patriarchy in the home. And that's what makes this feminist to its core. It's saying that in order for us to have any kind of freedom, political or otherwise, women need to be free. So the long-term consequences of this are significant, because what we see also in Iran is that young girls in schools, elementary school students, middle school students, high school students are, as you guys showed on your piece, are throwing out those who have enforced these laws in their schools for over four decades. And so this is just the start of women and girls seeing their power, seeing it reverberate, and then seeing it and seeing so many people around the world showing solidarity to it. And that is significant for Iran, but it's also significant for all of us as we're sitting here contemplating how we're going to be fighting back against all of these laws that are trying to restrict our bodies now. We are now seeing a very confrontational, militant form of feminism rising up from Iran, showing us how to do that.
During a speech in the European Union Assembly, a Swedish member of the parliament, Abir al-Salani, cut her hair in solidarity with the Iranian protest Tuesday evening in Strasbourg, France.
The hands of the regime of the mullahs in Iran is stained with blood. Neither history nor Allah or God Almighty will forgive you for the crimes against humanity that you are committing against your own citizens. We, the peoples and the citizens of the EU, demand the unconditional and immediate stop of all the violence against the women and men in Iran. Until Iran is free, our fury will be bigger than the oppressors. Until the women of Iran are free, we are going to stand with you. Jian, Jian, Azadi, women, life, freedom.
There has been dramatic video of solidarity with the protests in Iran all over the world. In addition to the protests drawing thousands and thousands of people, including in Los Angeles, which has a very large Iranian-American community, and the Swedish MP that we just played, prominent French actresses from Juliette Binoche to Isabelle Huppert also posted a video online cutting their hair. Neil, if you can talk, since you're examining this video, one, about the video getting out of Iran, but two, the video of these actions of solidarity. How easy is it for people in Iran, for the women to see this solidarity when apps are being shut down, etc.?
Absolutely. So, yes, the internet crackdown is happening right now. I have a hard time reaching my family members, but Iranians are really smart. They know how to move and maneuver around state repression. It's something that they have been doing for years. So there are windows and ways in which that they can see the outside world and how videos are still getting sent out to people like me who are watching and monitoring. Videos are very much our primary window into what's going on in Iran, given the repression of domestic journalists and international journalists that at once were accredited to be based there. So this is really the primary way that we're seeing it. And seeing these videos of women in Iran cutting their hair, it's very moving. It's something we focused on in our piece. And when we spoke with one of our experts, Reza Akbari, about it, he said it's very much the symbol that is unique to these protests. It's women saying, you know, back to the morality police, back to the state. If this is what's bothering you in a sarcastic, bitter way, let me cut it off. It's very powerful what they're doing. And something that really caught my eye when we were watching the videos coming out, specifically with cutting hair as a form of protest, is there was a video of a protester's funeral. So often in the past, when protesters have been killed by the state, they're very much dissuaded from being public at all about it. It's a quiet burial and things like that. But we saw a video broadcast from one of these funerals that was put on social media that you can see this open grieving, that you can see people grieving for the young family member who was killed in these protests. One of her family members begins to cut her hair over the casket. And so making, you know, not only making this funeral a public statement, which is in itself is very new, shocking, and bold in these protests, but adding that visual of cutting her hair on top of it is just, yeah, it's incredibly moving to see these images.
Professor Bajorli, your response, what do you think accounts for the extent of global solidarity in this very visual and open way, not just demonstrations, but so many women cutting their hair and posting it online? And if you could compare this also, in 2009, you were in Iran during the protest called the Green Movement. What differentiates that one from this one?
Sure. So to answer your first question, I think the reason this is reverberating so broadly across the world is, again, we're feeling lots of frustrations all around the world with not just the rise of conservative power, but also just the concentration and the monopoly of power around the world, whether it's by our you know, different states that we all live in, corporations that were, you know, like all the applications that we all use and the ways in which that they are owned by very, very few companies. And so we're in this moment in which especially those in the millennial generation and what we call Generation Z are trying, they are showing outbursts of rebellion and just sort of being like, it's enough, towards different forms of power that we have around us, such as the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement, hashtag Me Too movement, hashtag Neonamas in Latin America, and so on and so forth. And this is a moment that is also another one of those where it crystallizes all of these frustrations. And that's one of the reasons I think it is catching on and showing so much there's so much solidarity around the world. As far as the difference between this and the 2009 movement in Iran, the Green Movement in Iran, that movement was still very much within the bounds of politics of the Islamic Republic. It was a movement for electoral integrity and for reform of the system. Today's movement it's not calling for reform. Today's movement is calling for a new vision of politics. It's calling for a vision of politics that is about life and not destruction, and that is about the future and women at the helm of it. That is significantly different. It is the protesters today in Iran, they are in many ways, they've moved beyond the state. This is no longer about the state. This is about trying to create a new political imagination of what comes after the Islamic Republic. And so this is why this is such a significant moment. It's not that tomorrow the regime is going to come toppling down, but it's that for the first time we have a national movement of sorts that has moved beyond the parameters of the state, is no longer looking to reform the state, and that is calling forth a completely new vision for politics in Iran.
Well, Narges Bajoghli, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Anthropologist, professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, author of Iran Reframed, Anxieties of Power in the Islamic Republic. We'll link to your piece in Vanity Fair, headlined Woman, Life, Freedom, Iran's Protests or Rebellion for Bodily Autonomy. And Nilo Tabrizi, I want to thank you in Vancouver, journalist and writer, currently a video journalist at The New York Times, where your most recent piece is titled What Video Footage Reveals About the Protests in Iran. We're going to end this segment with the renowned political activist, scholar and author Angela Davis, who expressed her solidarity with protesters in Iran in a video posted on social media. This is an excerpt.
I want to offer my heartfelt solidarity to all those in Iran who have decided that Mahsa Amini's death at the hands of the Islamic Republic shall not be in vain. As one of the many scholar activists in the United States who has identified for a very long time as an ally of progressive and radical movements in Iran, I offer my condolences to Mahsa Amini's family and friends, and I say thank you to all those whose militant refusals directed at the regime, along with its morality police, have created the occasion for Mahsa Amini's name to reverberate around the world. In her name, people are standing up and are saying no to the repression meted out by the Islamic Republic. They are harbingers of hope not only for the people of Iran, but for all of us who want an end to racial capitalism, misogyny, economic repression, and who strive for more habitable futures for all beings on this planet. Long live Mahsa Amini.
Political dissident, activist, author Angela Davis, sending her message of solidarity with the women of Iran. Coming up, we'll also hear from India. And as India's prime minister offers to help efforts to end the war in Ukraine, we'll speak to the prominent Indian activist, Kavita Krishnan. Stay with us.
برای تو یه کوچه رخصیدن، برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن، برای خواهرم، خواهرت، خواهرامون، برای تغییر مغزها که پوسیدن، برای شرمندگی، برای بیپولی، برای حسرت یک زندگی معمولی، برای کودک زبال گرد و آرزوهاش، برای این اقتصاد دستوری، برای این هوای آلوده، برای ولیعصر و درختای فرسوده، برای پیروز و احتمال انقراضش، برای سگهای بیگناه ممنوعه، برای گریه های بیوقفه، برای تصویر تکرار این لحظه، برای چهره ای که میخنده، برای دانش آموزا، برای آینده، برای این بهشت اجباری، برای نخبه های زندانی، برای کودکان افغانی، برای این همه برای غیر تکراری، برای این همه شعارهای تو خالی، برای
Because of Mariah by the Iranian singer Shirvin Hajipour, which has become the unofficial anthem of the Iran protests. The song's lyrics are taken entirely from messages Iranians have posted online about why they're protesting. Shirvin Hajipour posted the song September 28th and received 40 million views before he was forced to take it down. He was arrested the next day, was released earlier this week on bail. He's awaiting trial. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we turn now to look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine with a focus on India's response. On Tuesday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi spoke by phone with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Modi's office released a statement saying, quote, he expressed his firm conviction that there can be no military solution to the conflict and conveyed India's readiness to contribute to any peace efforts, unquote. This came just days after India joined China, Gabon, and Brazil in abstaining from a vote at the UN Security Council condemning Moscow's annexation of four regions in Ukraine. Last month, Modi told Russia President Vladimir Putin that today's era is not one for war. Modi's remarks at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Uzbekistan were widely interpreted as criticism of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But despite Modi's comments, India has seen its economic ties to Russia grow since the February invasion. India now imports about 750,000 barrels of oil from Russia per day. That's up from about 20,000 barrels a day a year ago. Joining us is Kavita Krishnan. She is a prominent feminist activist, recently stepped down from her leadership position of the Communist Party of India in opposition to the party's stance on the war in Ukraine. Why don't we begin right there, Kavita, and welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Talk about why you stepped down and what India's position is and what the Communist Party's position is. You're a longtime Marxist-Leninist feminist.
That's right. I think that across various ideological spectrums in India, there is a lot of misinformation about the war, about Russia's invasion, and therefore a lot of sympathy for Russia rather than for Ukraine. The vast majority of Indians and Indian political formations do not see Ukraine, do not acknowledge Ukraine as such. They have an old relationship with the Soviet Union, and they see Ukraine as sort of vaguely some sort of satellite of Russia. So I think that that is a more general problem. But on the left, I think the problem is much more acute. In India, you have a far right, which is ideologically aligned with Putin's project. You had posters put up in support of Russia's invasion by Hindu supremacists in the center of Delhi, saying that Putin will achieve a reorganization of the Soviet Union. He will he'll put together the Russian Empire again, the way that we want to put together an Indian Empire, an undivided India, which includes India and all its neighbors as part of India. That's the far right position. But the left position, the party I left was the CPIML. CPI and CPIM, these are parties which have a much more openly pro-Putin position. They are openly pro-Putin. They openly look forward to a relationship growing between Russia and China. CPIML officially says that it is in solidarity with Ukraine. But having said that, it undermines a whole lot of that by contributing to spreading a whole, many elements of Putin propaganda, namely referring to the 2014 Maidan protests in Ukraine as a U.S.-backed coup, referring to, you know, exaggerating the presence of neo-Nazis and Nazis in Ukraine, not acknowledging the extent of danger that Russia's fascist and imperialist project presents to the world. And I think above all, the main problem there lies in the sentence that I can quote from a recent write-up by the General Secretary of the CPIML. It says, regardless of the internal character of competing global powers, a multipolar world is certainly more advantageous to progressive forces and movements and so on. Now, the idea that means that, the idea that you must support those poles in the world that are seen as a challenge to America, which is the only country recognized as imperialist, and that all other poles, even if they comprise fascists and authoritarians like Putin or Modi or Bolsonaro or Xi, that somewhere or the other we have to be softer on those leaders, those regimes. We must temper our solidarity to the movements against those regimes. We must ration out our solidarities because it is our job to somehow maintain this balance of power. So this kind of realist rhetoric and realist ideological corruption of Marxism is, I think, what troubled me very deeply right now.
And Kavita, just on that question of supporting what might be or is developing into a more multilateral global frame, there have been many who've expressed hope in the economic alliance of BRICS, that is, of Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa.
Yeah.
What is your response to that? I mean, together, they constitute 41% of the world population, 24% of world GDP, and over 60% share in world trade.
You see, when it comes to economic cooperation, why not? But I think that the celebration of BRICS as some sort of, multipolar regionalism and so on. I saw the interview on Democracy Now! With Vijay Prashad, for instance. I find that deeply disturbing because for me, whether it's West or East, the main thing that should concern us now are the struggles against authoritarianisms inside various countries. Whether it's America, whether it's the UK and, you know, the Brexit context, whether it's Trump in America, whether it's Putin in Russia, whether it's Modi in India and so on and so forth. You have struggles for democracy against deeply authoritarian and fascist forces. And we should be talking about how to strengthen those forces. Instead of that, if you have a sort of blind and vulgar sort of economic, framework in which you look at the world and you start celebrating BRICS in itself or as of itself as some kind of democratic anti-imperialism, I think that is pretty dangerous because you're not looking at the politics of China, the politics of Russia, the politics of Brazil, the politics of India. China, for instance, in the region in which, India is, of course, and right now ruled by an openly Hindu supremacist Islamophobic government. Likewise, China is a country which is a model of authoritarianism from which India's regime, too, is taking notes and learning. It is openly Islamophobic in its actions towards putting Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps. It is backing, funding the Myanmar military, which is doing genocide against the Rohingya people. Surely these are things that at least the left ought to address, ought to mention, ought to recognize. Likewise, I find that large portions of the left do not even mention Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The interview with Vijay Prashad on Democracy Now!, for instance, he makes no mention of the word invasion. So it's as though there is some shadow war going on somewhere on some other planet between Russia and the West, where there's no mention of Russia's having invaded Ukraine and refused to recognize it and wanting to wipe it off the surface of the earth. So that is what I find deeply disturbing. And, you know, for the prospects of the left, as well as for the prospects of democracy in our world.
Kavita, could you speak specifically about what India's interests are now? I mean, obviously, as you pointed out earlier, India has a historic relationship despite being a part of the non-aligned movement. They were more allied with the Soviet Union during the Cold War than with the U.S. But now we just reported earlier that OPEC, for example, OPEC Plus, have decided to cut oil production by 2 billion barrels a day. Critics say that this will increase profits for Russia because they are one of the oil exporters, and the less oil there is, the higher prices will remain. India is one of the main importers of Russian oil. Could you talk about some of the other links between the two?
Well, India is one of the biggest exporters of arms from Russia. Importer. The biggest importer of arms from Russia. Russia is one of its main suppliers of arms. And I think that apart from that, you know, even when the war is going on, India recently held military exercises with Russia and China at Russia's behest. And India is, of course, also tries to very firmly position itself with America as part of its foreign policy position. So it's actually walking a tightrope. It would like to enhance its relationship with Russia. At the same time, it would not like to burn its bridges with America. So what you see India doing, that conversation you mentioned between Modi and Zelensky, and the earlier conversation between Modi and Putin, where he said, today is not the time for war, and so on and so forth. I think that you have to balance these words and their rather empty symbolism with India's actual actions. So India's actions have been on the floor of the UN have been to abstain from the earlier condemnation of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and now again on the Russian annexation of the Ukrainian territories. And I think that we also have to keep in mind this ideological, we should be paying much more attention here in India and in the world to the fact that the language Putin's last speech spoke about this rise of civilizational powers, which basically should have domination in the world rather than liberal democracy and LGBTQ rights and so on, which he associates with Western countries alone and Western power, Western hegemony. I think that is a dangerous rhetoric that finds a resonance even in Hindu supremacist organizations in India, as well as, even in other countries, even in China, for instance. The idea that human rights or LGBTQ rights or feminism are basically Western ideas and they have nothing to do, that they should not dominate the world. That is something challenged, of course, by the feminist protests you see in Iran or India or so many other places in the world, right? You see that people in all these countries, in the global south as well, want democracy. But according to this ideology that Putin, that Hindu supremacists in India, that China's CPC, that the kind of ideology that they are presenting now is that all these ideas represent Western domination and Western concepts of democracy to which we need not be answerable. So I think that that is something extremely dangerous that we need to pay attention to.
You have talked about Russia as really a center of the far right globally. If you could explain what you mean, that might surprise many.
Well, I think that the relationship between Russia and the campaign for Brexit, between Russia and Donald Trump, financial relationships as well as other political relationships, I think that those are pretty much well known by now. But I think that to dismiss talk of these as some kind of Russophobia or whatever it is would be wrong. I think that we do need to pay attention to the fact that Russia is trying to set itself up as this far right kind of rallying center. I think that in India, however, things are somewhat different. The Indian far right, the Indian Hindu supremacist movement has its own kinds of, resources and its own world. But there's no doubt that for a very long time, the Russian far right, Russian fascists like Dugin, have cultivated the far right in India. Dugin, in a 2019 article, specifically refers to Narendra Modi's election in 2019, his second election, as the rise of civilizational identity in India. This is identical with the language used by the RSS ideologue Ram Madhav in his article in the Indian Express in 2017, where he said that India, you know, the genius of India lies in these civilizational values of caste and religion and so on and so forth. And that, again, he said there that the ideas of Western liberal democracy are imposed on India by Nehru, and that Modi's government is the first government in Indian history which is genuinely in touch with Indian values. So I think that these relationships, in that article in 2019, Dugin quoted Dattopant Tengri, who was an RSS leader, the leader of the Hindu supremacist organization to which Modi belongs. So
we have 10 seconds, Kavita.
Yes. I see these ideological relations as extremely important to pay attention to. And I think that all over the world, no matter which country you live in, supporting each other's struggles for democracy against authoritarianism and fascism. These are absolutely the most important, far more important than some kind of geopolitical balance.
We have to leave it there. Kavita Krishnan, prominent feminist activist in India, stepped down from her leadership position in the Communist Party of India, speaking to us from Balai, India. I'll be speaking at Brown University in Providence today at 4. All are welcome at Pembroke Hall. I'm Amy Goodman with Nirmin Sheikh.
Tom Chapin, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome to Whiskey Before Breakfast, or the Tuesday Roots program. I am Mando Richard, and we've got a great show lined up for you. I know you're going to enjoy it. We'll have a liquored up set like we always do at the very beginning, and we'll close down with a gospel set, and we'll hear from Woody Snyder in a little bit. We've got lots of great music for you today. Let's get things rolling right away. Here comes Don Reno with a classic from the bluegrass side of the family, Hot Corn, Cold Corn.
Upstairs, downstairs, out in the kitchen. Upstairs, downstairs, out in the kitchen. Upstairs, downstairs, out in the kitchen. Old Uncle Bill just around in a pigeon. Yes, sir. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the jimmy john. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the jimmy john. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the jimmy john. Farewell, Uncle Bill, say in the morning. Yes, sir. Well, old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill him up again? Old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill him up again? Old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill him up again? I ain't had a drink since I don't know when. Yes, sir.
Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the Jimmy John. Hot corn, cold corn. Bring along the Jimmy John, hot corn, cold corn. Bring along the Jimmy John. Farewell, Uncle Bill. See you in the morning. Yes, sir.
Are coming, the children are crying. The preachers are coming, the children are crying. The preachers are coming, and the children are crying. Chickens scratching, and the toenails flying. Yes, sir.
Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the Jimmy John. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the Jimmy John. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the Jimmy John. Farewell, Uncle Bill. See you in the morning. Yes, sir.
Drinking whiskey and end up drinking wine.
Cheap old wine and whiskey.